Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with self-publishing author Michael Philip Cash. His book, Route 10, is definitely a must-read for horror and thrillers lovers. In his book, Cash creates the worst of circumstances for Seth and his growing family as a cicada infestation destroying the world order as we know it. But before we start, let's learn a little bit more about Michael. Born and raised in Long Island, Michael has always had a love for horror, thrillers, paranormal, and action writing. Earning a degree in English and an MBA, he has worked various jobs before settling into being a full-time author. He currently resides on Long Island with his wife and children. For more information on Michael and his book, visit his website at www.michaelphilipcash.com. And that is Michael, PhilipCash.com. Hi, Michael. How are you doing today?
Hey, Susan. Great. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you so much to being with us. This is the second time I talk to you, and this is for our listeners, is your book, Route 10, and has a ton of creepy crawlers, flying things that for the life of me, don't know why would somebody write about them, because I am, like, terrified about bugs, and, of course, that's why you're writing about them. So I wonder, what does it go into your mind to make you decide to write about bugs? Why cicadas?
Great question. And first of all, I want to thank you for having me here again. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and to all the listeners, thank you. Why cicadas? The inspiration was, you know, listen, I like bugs as the, I hate bugs as much as the next guy. You know, bugs are, you know, they're creepy, they're gross, they're disgusting. And I felt that, you know, what will play on the reader's psyche? You know, what will make the reader so kind of like creeped out and gross without going to the extent of just, you know, pure gratuitous, you know, disgustingness? I mean, I don't even know if that's a word, but what will make it where the reader is, understands what I'm talking about without it sounding too corny? And the scary thing about Brood 10 is that cicadas are real, that Brood 10 is a real thing. And we had something like that in the Northeast this past summer. It wasn't to the magnitude it was in the book, but they were saying along the lines of billions and billions of these bugs. And, you know, I thought what this would make a great story. And the inspiration, I got to tell you, the inspiration was from watching Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. You know, this generation needed their own bug story without making it too cheesy of having you know, without making the bugs, you know, mutants or really weird, just this natural infestation that can occur, you know, and just play into the reader, because nobody that I know likes bugs at all.
I think you really hit the nail with they're real, because when I was little, I was a tomboy, and I would just grab and play with any bugs. I mean, you name it, cicadas included. We had tons of them in Venezuela. And they actually, what was disgusts me now that caught my attention when I was a kid, was that they shed their skin, and I would find the whole animal skin stuck on the mango trees of the backyard of our house. And so I thought that was awesome. We would do like contests to see if we would find more skins of cicadas around between me and my brother. But it wasn't until I was like 17. That I went to a party, and the parties down there were in the backyard, and I guess they brought this DJ guy, you know, it was the end of the 70s, we had the lights and whatnot, and somehow the lighting and the noise, the vibrations of the loud music bothered some kind of nest of cockroaches in a tree.
And
they flew out, and I had cockroaches from the top of my head to my toes.
Yeah, I believe it.
And I didn't sleep for years. I took like 20 showers. I was crying, passed out. You name it. I went through the whole horrible. And since then, if I see a cockroach or anything crawling on the floor, I'll get on the table and wait for my dog to eat it or something.
Yeah.
So
you and the rest of society. There's just something about bugs that just creeps everybody out. And you know, I could have written a novel on a snake infestation, but you know, it just didn't seem real. And cicadas are real. They're a real bug, and there is such thing as Brood 10 that comes out every year. And it's, you know, each year it's a different Roman numeral. Brood 10 sounded very ominous, so you know, that's why I chose that.
So I wonder, and I've always wondered about this, and I am so happy that I have the chance to ask an expert. How do you go about doing research for, you know, for this horror novel that you're writing about cicadas? Is it daunting to find all about the animal? I mean, how deep do you need to go to make it real in the book?
Well, also another great question. You can make it as real as you want, and you can make it as fake as you want. And I feel that really good novels, you know, when you're reading it, you're asking to yourself, could this really have happened? And there is a wealth of information. And it wasn't so much about the bugs, because like I said, you could have written a book about snakes. You could have written a book about, you know, a monkey infestation. You could have done anything, but it had to have been something that was real that could have occurred. I feel that Google is by far my best friend research tool. Google and just going into the depths of Google and learning more about, you know, cicadas and their mating habits and you know, the damage they can do and the destruction that can really happen. But you don't just start at cicadas. I mean, this is really a book about preparing, and it's about catastrophe. The catastrophe that I experienced last year was Superstorm Sandy on Long Island. It was horrible. I mean, the destruction that this storm left was like, you know, we've never seen anything like this, and I've been living here for 35 years. So to research it is also to live it. And to live it, you could look in the news any day about destruction and see what's going on and incorporating it into your story. And like I said, I hate to be redundant, but last time I spoke to you, you know, I mentioned about Save the Cat. And if you can incorporate a good story with something that's real, I think you got a winner in any type of form of creativity that you're doing, whether it be a short story or a novel, a screenplay. So, you know, that's there's unlimited wealth out there. And as long as you incorporate a good story and the right elements in that story, you know, hands down, it's going to work.
Yeah. And you also hit another key, I think, with this book, and you mentioned it in this answer, is the prepping. You know, there's so many times that we have to prep ourselves, you know, because of natural disasters like hurricane or floods that are coming. You know, even here in Austin, we've been having rain for 4 days, and, you know, I just automatically went shopping and got more of everything so that I didn't have to go out in the middle of the storms and stuff.
Right.
So are you a prepping specialist now? Can you give us tips about prepping? Or
I'm more of a paranoia than a prepper, but yeah. I mean, look, you know, in the book, I had two dichotomies. I had people that didn't prepare, and you saw what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And I also had people that did prepare, and you saw what happened to them. And it's really what you feel is most important. I mean, last year, same dichotomy. I knew people that prepped for Superstorm Sandy, and they had gas for the 2 weeks that there was no gas. They had electricity when everyone on Long Island didn't have electricity. They had food for 2 weeks when everything was closed. So then there was the other spectrum of people who didn't prepare and who had no gas and who had no food. And who had nothing to prepare, and had nothing to eat, nothing to sleep. There was no heat in the house. It was cold last October when the storm hit. So you better to be safe than sorry. But even if you do prepare, it still sometimes doesn't really matter, because once nature decides to turn on you, it doesn't matter how many canned goods you have in the house. Nature's going to decide. You know, it's going to shake you off like George Carlin once said. That nature's going to shake you off like dandruff on a T-shirt. You know, and there's not much you can do. And like I said, I think I proved that in Brood 10, that the people who did prepare got screwed, and the people who didn't prepare got screwed. So for me personally, I'd rather be safe than sorry. I'd rather have the canned goods. I'd rather have the electricity. I'd rather have the gas in my car than to just say, ah, nothing's going to happen. You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think that what's interesting, too, that it also shows, you know, how people deal with it. The ones that didn't prep and the ones that they prep, that got, you know, that got everything in there, just have to confront their reality. And,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, and I love stories like this because of that. I must say that I was in Florida when Wilma came, and we were without power for 3.5 weeks. And
right.
I did not have a generator or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I had tons of wood that fell off all
right.
the streets. We were blocked in our road for 2 weeks. We couldn't get the cars out. So I couldn't go and get water. I couldn't go and do anything. And thank God I had water. I had, you know, I always had water in my house. I always had, like, canned
right.
stuff and whatever. But what was amazing is just how things came together, you know. And I am not a survivalist. I don't go camping. I don't do anything. But suddenly, mm-hmm. like, the instinct kicks in, and, you know, she knew we were in trouble when she saw me going out with a machete cutting wood to make myself
right.
coffee, because I had to have my coffee in the morning.
Right, right.
And then
right.
the next day, the coffee was irrelevant because I was not going to go through all the trouble just for coffee. You know what I mean? So it's
right.
just how
right.
everything changes, and this is what I love about stories like this. So do you put yourself in that position? Do you imagine what it would be like for you, and that's how you come up with all these reactions? Or I'm wondering what...
I mean, yes. Listen, everyone should always be prepared in a type of emergency. And my family, I have a wife and I have 2 kids, and I, you know, my brother lives around the corner from me with his family, and my parents live a mile away. And there's always a contingency plan, and I really feel that's important. And that's also what I tried to convey in the book. You should have a contingency plan that if something is coming, listen, if something, you know, if a meteor hits America, it doesn't matter how much you plan, it's not going to matter. But if you know that there's a storm coming, you have to batten down the hatches, and there should be an emergency contingency plan that you should make with your loved ones and your family and see what's worth it. Like you said, with the coffee, like you have to have the coffee until you realize, well, you know, maybe I don't need it anymore, you know, and that's what you need to get wood, you know, should you plan beforehand? I feel that it's the right thing to do, and I have that plan with my family. I know that if, God forbid, there's another storm strikes, we know where we're going to have to go. Any type of emergency, if there's a rat infestation, we have plans on where to go and what we have to do. And I feel the protection is the right thing, especially if you have children. And I feel that if, you know, listen, on 9/11, I just talk about emergencies. On 9/11, I was in Queens, and my family was on Long Island, and there were no telephones all morning. You couldn't get in touch with anyone because the entire system was jammed. So you couldn't get to anybody, but because we had contingency plans, we knew where to go, who to meet up with, who to talk to, and where to stay without even speaking to the family. And we knew that we had to meet in this one location. It was my mom and dad's house at the time, and we knew that we had to be there and wait there until we got further word on what to do. We just had to find that contingency, and we had it. We knew. So for all the readers out there and the listeners, the smartest thing is to just speak with your family and say, listen, if something does happen, we should do this. And it can't hurt to do that. Would it be foolproof? No, nothing is foolproof. But you still should be able to meet up with people without having a cell phone. And I feel part of the thing in the book was technology, that once technology is taken away, people rely way too much on social networking, on email and cell phones, and I'm not a hypocrite. You know, I have an iPhone. I love my iPhone. But I know one day, if God forbid something happens to that network and I can't communicate with people, I still verbally communicate with them, knowing that we have to do this, this, and this. You know, I'm not on Facebook personally, and same thing with Twitter. I don't believe in that type of stuff. I feel that, you know, if you need to get in touch with someone, you have to get in touch with them, not through a social media outlet.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, technology has certain purposes, and for those purposes are correct, but, we do rely on them for everything, and I think that that's really going to be a big problem the day that, you know, we don't have them in front of us.
That's exactly right.
Because, I come from a different era, and, you know, growing up in Venezuela, you know, you would actually, sometimes we wouldn't have powers, and sometimes we wouldn't have water, and so we always plan ahead. to have make sure that we have water,
right.
And you know, fill out the laundry room to clean or washing water the wash machine and stuff like that, and buckets, and we always had that instilled, even if we didn't realize it, you know. And that
right.
actually is what made my day when I found myself without power for two and a half, even 3 weeks, because it came for a couple of days
right.
and went away. So
right.
So yeah, so I think that, you know, and people don't realize this, but you know, reading books like Bruten and other books that are apocalyptic or that they have you know, natural disasters and everything, really gives you a lot of information, because like you say, you're making it real to click that, you know, to hit that nerve in our brain. So I think that this is wonderful what you did. You know, can you give us
Thank
a tip
you.
About prepping? I want to get something to that. Okay, what did you learn when you were imagining yourself in that situation? Do you need to be really paranoid, or you know, do you always have stuff on your? I mean, what? When do you know that there's trouble? Do you wait for the news?
Well, you know, I wanted to take the story itself. I mean, prepping itself. You know, yeah, you can never have enough cases of water. You can never have enough canned goods. You can never have, you know, everyone in this country should have a generator, especially the people who live in the storm areas, you know. There's things to do to prepare for any type of emergency, and that's what the theme is in the book. But I wanted to take something that was the worst-case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And what could the worst-case scenario be? Is someone, I don't want to prep. I'm not interested. You know, it's stupid, and there are little bugs. You know, what can they possibly do? And I want to take an element that would make that would up the stakes. And again, in the screenwriting book that is my Bible, Save the Cat, and his wife is due around the time that there's this epic bug infestation in the Northeast, and everything stops. Everything. People that are so reliant on Facebook, and people so reliant on email and cell phones, and they don't really regard what else, you know, is around them. What would happen if this woman that he loves is going to have his baby in 9 months when the infestation is going to occur? What is he going to do? And you know, I don't want to give it away because it was thrilling to write, and it was exciting to write. Part of me knew where I was going with it, but part of me really feels that every single time I read it, are these people going to survive this? You know, and I wrote the book, and it's just this thing of, are they going to get through this? Are they going to have the kid? Is the kid going to be okay? Is the wife going to be okay? Are their friends going to be okay? You know, and I pitted these people. This, the main character's name is Seth, and I know people like Seth, you know, very cocky, very, you know, doesn't really need anyone's help. He could do everything himself, and he doesn't, you know, he looks down on people who are trying to prepare, and, you know, his sin is sloth, and he's kind of lazy. Not lazy for himself, but lazy, you know, for preparing and taking care of what needs to be done, because he is going to have a big responsibility, and the responsibility is that of a child.
Yeah.
And he doesn't prepare, and the outcome is pretty catastrophic. You know, the
so
worst case situation.
Everybody should have some kind of idea what their situation is. And,
yeah, and they don't. In the book, they don't.
Ahead.
I took the
basically.
Yeah, I took the worst case scenario, and I amplified it 100 times.
Yeah. And it worked out great for the book.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Michael Philip Cash, author of Bruten. Stay tuned because we're going to continue this fun and insightful conversation with Michael about horror box stories, disaster prepping, and horror screenplay and novel writing, as much as many other topics. But in the meantime, you can check out his book, Brute 10, by visiting his website at www.michaelphillipcash.com. That is Michael, P-H-I-L-L-I-P, cash.com. Now, I know that Brute 10 was a screenplay first, so I'm wondering, what's the difference? You know, let's compare writing horror novels versus horror screenplays. What's more difficult for you?
You know, Brute 10, you're right, 100%, started as a screenplay. I had the idea in my head. I wanted a new version of The Birds, of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, and I wanted to make it into a screenplay. And I wrote it basically how the book was, you know, beat for beat of you know, the found footage aspect of it, that, you know, this guy is filming his wife's pregnancy for 9 months, and there's this epidemic that's coming. The screenplay, you know, the opening scene is the hospital scene where the paramedic comes in with the actual camcorder that was found by him from Seth, who's the protagonist. And, you know, with the screenplay, the hospital scene in the hospital room took 2 pages. In Brood 10, it took like 20, you know, 25 pages. I mean, I could describe how the hospital smelled, how the hospital looked. Even with Seth's house, you can go and tell you what the living room looked like and how they were feeling, you know, when Lara, who's his wife, tells him, "I'm pregnant." In the screenplay, you can't say how Seth feels. You have to say, Lara says she's pregnant. Seth gasps, or Seth jumps up and down, you know, excited. In the book, you have to, you can expound on so many different levels emotionally. It's night and day. It's not even, you know, when someone says they're a writer, you know, they really are a writer of screenplays, and they are writers of novels. It's a completely different game. You know, it's like basketball and tennis. You know, yeah, they involve a ball, but it's a completely different sort of game. One, you got to shoot through a hoop. The other, you're playing one-on-one with someone else with a racket. So, you know, and you need help on both parts. You know, you need to do your research on both parts. Just sit down and write a novel. You know, you need to know where you're going with that. And I took the same elements of my screenplay and put it into my novel, just with more detail.
I'm curious to know, which one do you find more enjoyable for yourself?
You know, screenwriting has always been my first love. Hands down. I love the art of screenwriting. I love being able to convey so much in just one or two sentences in an action, where novels are, you can go into the depths of people's emotions. You can go into what the brick was like in the room. I mean, there's so many different levels on it. It really, you know, when someone says they're a writer, you could say, I'm a writer of screenplays, or I'm a writer of novels. I'm a novelist. It's the same type what you're doing, you're still writing, but it's a totally different sport. I mean, novels can be football, novels can be basketball, and screenwriting can be tennis. You're still using a ball to win the game, but it's two totally separate sports. I feel that screenwriting I love, and I generally write out screenplays before I even start the novel, because it really gives you places where you have to be, where novels you can just write and write and write and be involved in the story in so many different ways. For instance, the hospital scene in Brood 10, for a screenplay, it took me 2 pages to write. That's all I could fit in there. And, you know, in the hospital where they find the camera that Seth was filming for the past 9 months, is kind of like an epilogue, but it is a prologue. And, you know, in Brood 10, the novel, the prologue is 25 pages, and it's 20-something pages. Just, you're writing about people's histories and where they're from and what they like and what they don't like. It's two totally separate, you know, again, two totally separate sports. Then I prefer screenwriting, but, you know, I could write a screenplay in a couple weeks. Novels are just, you could take months to write a novel, because it's just never ending what you can put in there.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say that, because I find it the other way around. So everybody's different. I mean, I could never write a screenplay just because it's too short for me.
Sure.
I need the space. I mean, I cannot fit everything that is in my head. The picture that I have in my head, I cannot fit it into a short frame. And,
of course.
Yeah, and, you know, and I wish I could, because I'm a movie fan, and to write screenwrites to me would be like the total bomb. So. So, but I just can't do it. And it's, I think it's great. So I really think that this would be a great movie, by the way.
Thank you.
Cicadas are like such a, I think, a known animal out there in the sense.
Right.
I haven't seen really any horror movies about them or anything. And they were one of my favorite things to find when I was a kid. So
right.
I was drawn to your book right away because of that.
Thank you.
I want to tell our listeners.
I would like to mention before, I'm sorry for interrupting, I would like to mention that I won a contest out of 4,500 contestants. I came in the top 20. I came in fourth place for the script for Brood 10. Because,
oh, cool.
It was, you know, a company called scriptpipeline.com. You know, I entered into a contest and I came in the top 20. They said the script was that good. They called it The Birds for the Facebook Generation. It was the right script, you know, at the right time.
Yeah, so maybe we'll get discovered as a movie as well. That's great.
Part of the win was they're circulating the script throughout the entertainment industry, you know.
Great.
It's exciting. It really is.
Well, keep me posted. I would love to watch the movie.
Believe me, so would I. So would I.
I want to give our listeners your website because I think your website is awesome, and it has the book trailer of Brood 10 and with all your other books and your new projects and your blog. It's also, I find it so interesting as well. And listeners, his website is michaelphillipcash.com, and that is Michael, P-H-I-L-L-I-P, cash.com. Tell me something, Michael. I know you're working on something new, and what I find fascinating about your writing style is that there's really a huge, huge mix of everything. I mean, you do the screenwriting, you do the novels, and then the topics of your novels are different, and you kind of experiment and have fun with different things. So what are you working now? What new projects are coming out?
Sure. As of now, my new novella came out, and I kind of wanted to do something short, sweet, and quick. I didn't want to make it a long, drawn-out novel, so I came out with a novella called The Hanging Tree. And The Hanging Tree is along the lines of the spiritual, you know, a paranormal type book. There's I don't want to give it away, but it's about choice, and it's about people making the right choices and decisions that affect everything else in their life. And you know, it has a special meaning to me. And like I said, I didn't want to make it a long, drawn-out novel. I'm working on something much bigger now. I'm working on two novels now, and I'm working on a few screenplays here and there. But so The Hanging Tree is out. It's on Amazon now. I am working on a fantasy novel now, like a dystopian future fantasy novel, what do they call those things? Like a space opera almost. I'm a fan, you know, I was born in the 70s, so I'm a product of the 80s. I'm a huge fan of Star Wars, The Legend of Zelda, Lord of the Rings. I mean, that stuff is, it's the pinnacle for me. And I didn't really want to be typecasted under one certain genre. You know, Brood 10 is horror thriller. Stillwell is ghost. You know, I wouldn't even say horror, ghost thriller, and the Hanging Tree is more, you know, paranormal, even little hints of romance in there. Same thing with Stillwell. But I wanted to do something along the lines of fantasy. I grew up on that stuff. That's my heritage. You know, I'm now introducing Star Wars to my own son, who loves it as much as I did, loves it even more than I used to. So I'm working on this a space opera, so to speak, and it's an adventure. It's a cross between Hamlet, Shakespeare was the one that started me to get into writing to begin with. I am obsessed with Shakespeare. I love every book that has, you know, with Shakespeare, you know, all the novels he wrote. I'm creating something along those lines, and it's, the fun part about writing fantasy is you're creating your own epic. You're creating your own world. And again, as long as the story hits the beats and it's not boring and the scenes aren't long, you know, I feel that I feel it's going to work. And this is my first foray into fantasy. And I'm having a blast with it. I had a great time with Brood 10, Stillwell, The Hanging Tree, and a few of the other works that I'm working on. But this fantasy is it's great. You're literally creating your own universe. And I've always wanted to do that.
Do you use? I know that you have a little formula for horror books and stuff like that. Do you use the same formula for all the topics that you?
Absolutely, Absolutely. Now, you know, for horror in the screenplay book, you know, you got to have the monster, the house, the sin. You know, for there's other types of genres that you have that you should be plugging away at. You should be, you know, using that as a formula. And for the new novel, I haven't come up with a title yet. You know, along the lines of a universe story or something like that. But how it's working is there's another thing called the Golden Fleece, where a crew of people go out to go find that missing lost item that needs to be found. Kind of along the lines of Lord of the Rings, but, you know, without a ring, and, you know, there's much less people than the actual Fellowship. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but,
Yeah, I do.
Okay, for any Lord of the Rings fans out there, they'll understand, you know, it's more along those lines of, and in my case, I'm doing a man and a woman who have to go on this outer space planetary journey to go find these elements that are going to help save his kingdom.
Wow.
And, Yeah, it's super. It's so much fun because you're literally creating your own verbiage. You're creating your own language in the vein of Avatar, which was a brilliant movie. You know, you're not copying it. You're using what has worked. And in this case, it's the Golden Fleece that there's a mission, and you know your protagonist goes on a mission with his fellow, you know, with his cronies. I don't know if cronies is the right word, with his team. And the whole point of that is, he's going to go over many obstacles and many, roadblocks and whatnot. And it's not what he does to get over that, but it's who he becomes as a person at the end of the story that matters the most. So he's going to start out as kind of like an obnoxious teenager, and he's going to end up as a superhero, as someone who comes back as a man. Who, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but where I'm going with it, it's along those lines. It's ancient Greek mythology. You know,
yeah.
It's the story of Jason the Argonauts, where they go on this journey and they come back totally different from when they left.
Yeah. It's so much fun to listen to you to talk because
you can
tell that this is like a big, enthusiastic, everything that you're doing is, you're so enthusiastic about it, you can tell that you're living your dream.
Thank you. Yes, I am.
So I'm wondering, you know, when you were a kid and you were dreaming, you know, what would you tell now that you are living your dream? What would you tell all those kids that were like you when you were dreaming, knowing what you know now?
Mm-hmm. When I was young, my goal, my passion was directing movies. I wanted to be, or even writing. I wanted to be a writer, a movie director, anyone that had to deal with entertainment. I was fascinated by it. My family was in that industry, not the way you would think, but they serviced the film industry. And I loved it. I felt it was and I didn't love it for the fame because I don't want to be famous. I'm not looking to be, you know, a Kardashian, quote-unquote. I'm not looking for that reality show fame. I'm looking for creativity. And the whole point is that what you're doing in your own time that's going to be read by millions and millions of people – that is the biggest high you can ever experience in your life. And if anyone who wants to do what they're doing, there are so many tools out there. There's unlimited knowledge on the internet, in libraries, in bookstores, on how to achieve your dreams. I'm telling you, I'm a normal person. I don't have this lap of luxury lifestyle. I don't drive Ferraris. I don't live in a 10,000 square foot house. I'm a normal person with two great kids, an amazing wife, a family. I have a mortgage, you know, like it's there's nothing sexy about it, but it's just so much fun. And if you want to do it, the world is yours. There's unlimited wealth out there. Anything that you want to learn about self-publishing, about writing, you literally just got to pick up a book and follow up on it, but you got to plan it and you got to do it. You got to schedule it to do it. Just say, I'll do it next week. I'll do it tomorrow. Next week is not a day of the week. You got to say, Monday, I'm starting my novel. I don't care what people say about me. Criticism, not criticism. People tried to stop me. Why bother? I had a great support system with my family. And people outside the family, don't bother. It's not worth it. You don't know what you're going to be competing against. Blah, blah, blah. They didn't think it was anything. And, you know, is it a national bestseller? No. But you know what? I'm ranked on Amazon under my book Stillwell. You know, people notice it. There are reviews on there, and people love it. And if they don't like it, I'm still grateful that they even read my work. You know, you can't have an A plus on critics, you know, 24/7. You're gonna have a lot of critics saying that you didn't do the right thing. You take it as constructive criticism and you move on and you try another thing. You just can't stop, you know, and even if a roadblock is put up in front of you, it's just, you got to find a way above, under, or through it, around it. You just got to get around it and, you know, just got to do it.
And the key words are, you can't stop, you know.
No.
I remember in the 1990s, before, I think my first publication on a magazine was in 1996. Before that, I collected every single rejection letter that I got, you know. And so when I would be writing on the, and some of them were like, okay, sorry, don't need it, or stuff like that. But some of them would give you, I mean, if you keep at it, then you will find this editor that gave me, like, wonderful tips on what to look for. And then I just kept, you know, improving the article. And then, I remember it was my first sale, and I got $300 for an article. And I was, like, blown away. And then you have to remember that my language, my first language is not English. So during that time, I was not only confronting the barriers that some people would say, are you crazy? You know, you're doing that in English, you know?
Right.
You know, you have to kind of just keep going. And now, you know, I'm doing, what you're doing is living my dream. And again, you really
hit
it. Just never stop, you know?
Don't stop. Listen, Napoleon Hill, the great Napoleon Hill, who wrote one of the books that changed my life, the Think and Grow Rich, he said, for every failure, there's the seed of an equivalent benefit. And if you can live by those terms, that if you know for every time that you failed, and don't even look at it like a failure, but every time that you know that it didn't work out, there's something else that will work out in the same paradigm, you're going to keep going. So if you fail 10 times, there's going to be succession of 10 times. There's going to be victory of 10 times. And it's going to be bigger than what the failures actually were, you know? And like you said, you got 100 rejection letters, but you finally did get published.
Yep. And then, you know, you keep at it. And that's the only – it's like, you know, imagine when you're a baby. If all of a sudden you say, okay, I just failed the first time trying to walk. I'm not going to walk again.
That's brilliant.
You know?
That's brilliant. That's the absolute truth. That's what life is all about. It's about it's about moving forward. And that's brilliant what you just said.
Yeah, so that's how you go. It's our instinct. You just have to keep at it. And I find you so inspiring and so cool that, you know, a horror writer is not just creepy. You know, you're a very inspiring guy.
Thank you. I don't like that horror stuff. I mean, I've read all the books on Amazon. It's all gratuitous, you know. There's no heart and soul in books. And I feel, I'm not saying, you know, in general, but the horror stuff, you know, yeah, am I a horror writer? Sure, I'll consider myself a horror writer. But I want people to think while they're reading, is there an inkling of truth to this? That's kind of like a bookend to our conversation. Is there an inkling of truth to Brood 10? That could this really happen? Are we prepared? You know, the family in the book wasn't, and you'll see what happened.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and I could really talk to you again and again.
Me too. I love speaking with you, Susan.
Yeah, let me know when you have your next novel, because I think they're all interesting. You somehow put messages in your horror or thrilling or fantasy books, and I think it's the best way to learn and get those messages is through a entertaining and thrilling experience. You know what I mean? Not just reading a narrative. I think it's a great way. It's what I love to do. I always find the messages in thrilling books as well. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. And you nailed it on the head. These are not just random books placed wherever they have to be. There's a deep message in the stuff that I write. Nothing is written out of my
you-know-what. You certainly made it fun to find. So,
thank you.
Thank you. I want to tell the listeners again your website. I really encourage you to check it out. I think you did a great job with your website. It's michaelphillipcash.com. And again, it's Michael, PHILLIP, cash.com. Check out his other new books coming out and the ones that are just came out. Again, thank you so much. It was so much fun talking to you again. We'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Susan, thank you so much.
listeners, thank you again for being with us. Thank you so much for supporting all of our authors, and especially in this case, Michael Philip Cash. And until
thank
next
you.
Time.